Well, I'm pleased to be here, and I have, in the first chance to talk here, I present a rather general title. And in principle, with this title, I could talk about what I learned in about 30 or 40 years in my academic career. And it's enough material for at least 10 lectures. So I will try to tell you something, maybe 50 minutes. And as the title says, I'm concerned with flow properties of complex fluids, but I will start out with a relatively simple fluid in the beginning. I should also mention that in Berlin, I have had many people helping me. One of them, Martin Kröger, is sitting here, and you can ask many questions concerning details to him. The substances we have been concerned with range from gases and simple liquids to colloidal dispersions, polymeric liquids, and anisotropic fluids like liquid crystals, ferrofluids, magneto- and electro-rheological fluids. And if time allows, I will present some results on those underlined here. The methods we used, and you believe me because I'm old enough, I grew up in a time where we had to rely on analytic methods like irreversible thermodynamics and kinetic theory based Boltzmann equation, Kirkwood-Smoluchowski, Fokker-Planck, depending on the medium. But we also, well, some time ago, got involved in non-equilibrium molecular dynamics computer simulations. And during this talk, I will focus on the last method, which we have been using in Berlin for quite some time. And that's the reason why many of those names, those persons have helped. Now let me start with something very conceptually very simple. You look at the viscosity of a colloidal dispersion, which is simple in the sense that the particles are spherical, and you study the viscosity of that substance as function of the shear rate for various concentrations. That's for a particular latex dispersion solved in glycol, which was done by, shows measurements made by Laun at the BASF in the literature. You find many examples of that kind. What's plotted here is the viscosity, which is the viscosity, logarithmic scale, as function of the shear geschwindigkeit, which is the shear rate. And what you see here, at a small volume fraction, 35%, there is a Newtonian viscosity, constant viscosity is constant, and then there's some weak shear thinning. At 43 volume fraction, there's a stronger decrease of the viscosity, and then there's an increase. And at a volume fraction around 52%, there's a strong decrease and a dramatic increase. So with this relatively simple system, it's a dense dispersion. Well, there's some polymer in it because those latex particles are made of a polymeric substance, but they are pretty spherical.
Now you understand that rapid increase is only in the capillary geometer, but not in the other geometry.
Oh, well, it depends whether it's accessible and whether you have stress control or flow control, but it's a real effect. And of course, that's a very wide range of shear rates, and usually you cannot cover such a wide shear rate with one instrument. That's why they're put together. Now I show you a picture which comes from a different source of information, namely a computer simulation, the kind we did 15 years ago already. This was a Leonard Jones system with a cutoff in the potential minimum, the interaction. That's WCA potential. And that's again the viscosity of the shear rate. And there one sees a constant viscosity, slightly decreasing with shear rate, a strong decrease and an increase. So qualitatively, it's a picture. Viscosity worth the shear rate, which one calls flow curve, which looks very similar. And again, I show here another experimental example where this strong decrease and the increase is shown for a real substance. So obviously, in a system which is even much, much simpler, it's a computer simulation I will describe, we find qualitatively similar behavior.
And the viscosity here is best divided by shear rate.
Yes. And, well, not a differential viscosity, really divided, as you say. Now, If one sees such a flow curve, of course one can ask, there must be structural changes going on in such a fluid. What are these? What are the reasons why we see this different behavior? And what's the interrelation between such a simple, real simple substance, which we had on the computer, and the colloidal dispersion? And of course, once we have understood this, we could look to more complicated substances. Now I will very briefly go through the method which we use, MD and NEMD computer simulations, and I assume everybody knows what we are doing is solving Newton's equation of motion. The force on particle I is usually, not always, but usually thought of as being a force, pairwise additive force between particles I and J. And what one can compute when you start from an initial condition is shown here. You have seen pictures of this kind. If you are show the traces of particles in a gas, in a liquid, or in a solid, follow them over some, say, 50 time steps, project the three-dimensional simulation on the sides of the box. There you see in the gas you have collisions, and here this wild motion. Everybody has a notion of that kind, what's going on in the liquid. And that's in the solid where particles are wiggling around. Of course, we are not interested in looking at thousands of these pictures or storing this data. What we are interested in the simulation are average values, like the pressure tensor, velocity distribution, pair correlation function, static and dynamic structure factors. And these quantities can nicely be extracted from the computer simulations. All one needs are the rules of statistical physics, which tell you how to compute these quantities. And that's what is done. That's something which started, you know, over 50 years ago, molecular dynamics. And before I come to non-equilibrium molecular dynamics, I just should specify what you all know. One has to specify an interaction potential. Leonard Jones can be one example, r to the minus 12, r to the minus 6, with some energy in front. And if you sketch this potential, you immediately see there is an energy scale set by the well depths and the length scale by the zero. And with a mass, so we work with dimensionless quantities. That's also standard. And what one has to know before one starts the simulation is what kind of density, what kind of temperature you would like to set, where you want to be within a phase diagram. That's the phase diagram of a Leonard Jones fluid. Temperature in reduced units, number density in reduced units. Here it said that reduced temperature 1, you have the gas at the low density, you have the liquid in coexistence, the gas. Here you have the liquid in coexistence with the solid. And I will show you results which are somewhere in here, that which are liquid under pressure. All this is known, and one technical detail I would like to mention is if one, even nowadays when you can work with millions of particles, it's sometimes useful to have a system without any boundaries. If you think you are doing a simulation with 1,000 particles, which is 10 by 10 by 10, and you have a wall, simulate a wall, and they have a boundary layer, and the boundary layer is just two particles on each side. So you take, or maybe three particles, so you take six away. So of your 1,000 particles, only 4 to the 3rd are the bulk. That's why one is interested in having methods which without any boundaries, and then one uses periodic boundary conditions, which is well known. And the essence of the periodic boundary condition is not only that particles are leaving and entering a basic cell and you have periodic images, but that when you have short-range forces, combine the periodic boundary conditions with the nearest image convention, which means if a particle 1 is looking around, and it sees here particle number 2, it's happy and interacts with that one. It notices, however, that the image 3 prime is closer than the original particle in here. And then the interaction is taken between those two particles because the image is closer than the original particle. That's the nearest image convention. Well, and then one can control the temperature here, for instance, by specifying the value, or the magnitude of the peculiar velocity, the actual velocity of a particle with respect to the flow velocity, if one has a flow going on. And then,
so can I ask a question? It's not obvious to me why you shouldn't double count the pairwise interactions. If the point of the periodic boundary conditions is to is to model an infinite system, then typically there will be a particle then.
No, no, if the current, well, maybe you can, but we don't do it, to be more specific. We use an interaction potential which is shorter than one half of the box length, the range, cut off. And there are many reasons why it's good to cut off. Okay. And the size of the box, of course, this is determined. You choose the particle, say you work with 1,000 or with 100,000, that's your number of particles, and then you say I want to have a reduced density 0.8 or 1, and then this determines the size of the box. The data are actually extracted from the basic box, not from, but the interaction may be out here. And this periodic image box is of some importance if one wants to understand how we treat the flow. You can infer dynamic properties from a computer simulation by looking at the fluctuations, equilibrium fluctuations, and via time, analyzing time correlation functions, or if you use some other tricks, you can infer values for transport coefficients. These are in equilibrium. However, it's very nice and useful to look at simulations where one mimics a real experiment. That's what's done in non-equilibrium molecular dynamics. We want to mimic a real shear flow. And there are various methods one can think of. But the simplest type of flow I will consider here is a plain Couette flow. So flow in x direction, gradient of the flow velocity in y direction. So and this dvx with respect to y, that's gamma, referred to as shear rate in the literature, rheology literature, it's usually referred to as gamma dot, but I call it gamma here. Now the question is, how does one produce or realize a simulation of such a flow? And this kind of non-equilibrium molecular dynamics simulation actually started about 30 years ago. First papers, there were two or three articles published in 72. And the first method one can think of is to have moving walls. You move walls like you do it in a real experiment. This was, for an instance, done by here quite close when seen from Europe. It was done in Livermore with Bill Hoover and Ashurst. And this here is a variant. What you see here are the velocities extracting over 5,000 time steps for the situation where a force is pulling the particles here in a layer towards the left, and others are pulled towards, that's towards the right, and that's pulled towards the left. And what you see here is that there is, so to say, two Couette flow profiles set up. These forces have to balance each other. This can be used now if one knows the cross-section area and the force, and reads off this diagram the shear rate from the gradient here, velocity gradient, then one can infer the viscosity.
So the walls are particles?
The walls are the particles. That's what you can do instead of using walls. One uses a force pulling. Actually, it's such a method with a sinusoidal varying force was used by in England. No. Singer and MacDonald. The MacDonald of Hansen MacDonald, Singer and MacDonald used such a method also in 72 with such a force. If, well, this is a variant of Lose and did this in Berlin maybe 15 years ago or so. This has the advantage that you can use the old periodic boundary conditions because one has two Couette flows. But if you have a close look, you see here kind of a kink, so one has boundary layer effects even without the wall. If one wants to avoid these boundary layer effects.
So this is a string of particles that is attached to.
No, there's not a string. That's filled. It's a dense fluid. It's all filled with particles. What is those particles which are in this layer, that layer, and this layer feel forces when they enter that. There is an extra external force.
But they're not allowed to move.
Oh, they're allowed to move everywhere. Free. This method would not work with a gas.
And
it works.
External
constant force in this direction, this, and oh, the forces cancel. One has to make sure that there, that's no overall motion that cancels.
Why is there a kink? Where is this?
Because these particles are driven, and those, You have to imagine that's a real dense fluid. Think of steel balls. You have some, and you are pulling some of them here, and this and that. And you get, we analyze that boundary layer behavior. It's very similar to what you would have if you would have a solid wall. It was just a fast method rather than to model a solid wall which apply this force within a restricted area here.
The solid wall is slip.
It could have slip. Depends when you make a draft, then it, yeah, there's some slip. We analyze the slip velocity if you extrapolate and what the actual velocity
is. Here the particles can cross the wall.
Then cross the wall. They can move freely because they are still within this periodic system. Well, if this is an interesting subject as such, but if one is not interested in these methods, and then one uses what is called, referred to as a homogeneous shear algorithm, infinite system still with the boundary conditions which were invented by Lees and Edwards. That's why they are referred to as Lees-Edwards method. There was later on a modification made by Dennis Evans, in this, which is essential if you want to run the simulation for a long time in a stable manner, which hardly are stressed in the literature. People who practice it, they know that you have to do more than those boundary conditions, but that's a different story. Now, here the idea is you assume, again, this periodic box, you assume that the images above and below are undergoing an ideal coed flow. If you start the flow, say at time t equal to 0, then the image of particle 3 has been displaced by a distance which is given by the shear rate times the time elapsed times this box length. And now if particle 1 looks around and decides with whom should I interact, it notices that the image to particle 3 is not here but there. So the force, if it's central force, the force is acting in this direction rather than that one. That's how the particles in here learn that a flow is going on. And then we check whether a flow, the proper flow profile is put up. Of course, one has to combine this. That has to do with a neighbor image convention. Of course, one has to combine this with this Lees-Edwards boundary conditions, which tell if a particle is leaving here, say, then it's not entering there, but displaced. These are the Lees-Edwards boundary conditions that you the proper displacement and change the velocities, because particles up here have an extra velocity in this direction here, they have an extra velocity when adjust over the wall. That's Lees-Edwards. But this something like this happens at each time step. Particles leaving and crossing occur less seldom if you have a dense system and small time steps. That's how.
But the particles in the image boxes are all moving with the same.
Yeah, that's the idea that DC, they have no.
There's no gradient, in other words, in the image.
No. It's just your sliding, like sliding bricks. Of course, there will be an effect. If a gradient is here, set up, then there will be one up there. But it's an image of that.
Sorry, can you repeat this point? So if a particle leaves the box, it will appear on the other side with the velocity given by.
But with the extra velocity, the difference, because if it's leaving here upwards, mm-hmm. it is displaced according to such a displacement, and its velocity is adjusted as if. That's the right velocity for this one, so to say. That is taken away, and this is, velocity is given. Otherwise, you would have, if you want to it, you would stir the whole system.
So as compared with the previous way of putting the shear, in here we are not applying a constant force, but we are applying an impulsion, right?
Because the condition, I'm applying a condition which ensures that there is a constant average shear rate. Not a force, is it?
But individually, each particle which crosses receives a kick, right? It's
It doesn't. I wouldn't say that it gets an extra kick, because the moment before it leaves off here, it is well adjusted to its surroundings, because its surrounding is flowing. That, and if I insert it down here. It has to be again well adjusted to its surroundings, so it has to flow with a different velocity. That's the velocity adjustment. It doesn't get an extra kick. The extra kick comes from this displacement here, so to say.
Okay.
This drives the flow. And one has to make sure that there are actually no extra kicks and things like this, or so smooth.
At the end, it's a homogeneous mass if you don't know where the boundary is. So there's no, this is quite different from the first method, which was inhomogeneous. This is a homogeneous system.
Really, you could shift those periodicity images here, the boundaries, wouldn't it?
So in here, you don't have any, the flow profile is strictly speaking linear, right?
It depends how we run the simulation. We can do it such that we enforce it to be strictly linear. Under certain circumstances, it's useful to give the system an extra freedom such that we only adjust an average flow profile. If it's in the Newtonian flow regime, it voluntarily assumes a linear flow profile. However, there are situations, and I will show you pictures, when then there are plug-like flows and things like this emerging.
If I understand correctly what you are saying, there is no boundary layers close to...
No, there's no boundary layer whatsoever. That's a homogeneous system in that way. So these two methods are on the market, so to say, and basically were invented about 30 years ago. They were tested, and there was a lot of discussion in the 70s and even early 80s or whatever. And I got involved about 20 years ago, so when I was... seen from nowadays, early, but from the early days, a latecomer to that. So once one knows to run such a simulation with flow, of course one has to ask again the question, how do we get the information on the viscous behavior? I want to brief here. Viscosity has to do with the pressure tensor or the stress tensor. I like to...
Yeah? Just one question. Can you use these same type of methods to simulate anything other than shear flow? In other words, can you trick the system into doing some other interesting
flow? Extensional flow. Well, you should ask, but I in all my life have always done shear flow, but Martin Kröger has done extensional flow and squeeze flow and all kinds of other flows. So it can be done. It's more tricky. It's much more.
Depends on the geometry of the flow and the geometry that you must ensure. But especially, unit elongation flow, you can do with the same method.
It should squeeze the. You have to deform the box, squeeze, and. But it's somewhat tricky, the problem is with plain shear flow, you can go to a stationary situation. If you start pulling something like or squeezing something like this stick, of course you see that you are in a non-stationary situation. There are tricks where one can also reach quasi-stationary states, but that's not so easy.
There's some tricks where you can get stationary states for elongation flows, but not all types of elongation flows. People in Australia are working on such airwaves.
It would be interesting to me to hear about those extensions.
Well, arrange somewhere. Yeah. That's one of the experts sitting here. Not me.
You can reach stationary flow if you remove heat from the system, right?
So yes, I will come. Yes. Okay. I should have mentioned it. That's why I mentioned that if you do an equilibrium simulation, you can do it also in an adiabatic system. If you shear the system, it's really generating heat. The viscous heating is going on. So we usually put on a thermostat. There are various thermostats, like Gaussian or Nossi-Hofer, and we use the simplest thermostat, which is appropriate equivalent to a Gaussian thermostat, which means that the total kinetic energy is fixed, but the kinetic energy with respect to the average flow. And this can be done, for instance, by rescaling the magnitudes of the velocities. That's the simplest version. But before, I should mention how we extract data on the viscous behavior from the system. The pressure tensor or the stress tensor, if some people who come from gas and liquids think in terms of pressure, those who come from continuum mechanics or mechanics like to think in terms of stress, for me it's the same, except for a sign. Plus or minus. But we know that microscopically the pressure tensor of such a system is made of kinetic and the potential contribution. And the kinetic contribution involves the peculiar velocity. Involves the peculiar velocity. If you look for the xy component of the pressure, we are interested in the xy component. There's a component which is zero in equilibrium, but which is non-zero for this flow geometry, which signals indicates that the viscosity is different from zero. So this xy component has a contribution from the peculiar velocity, the x component and the y component. This is transport of momentum. And it has a potential contribution, which involves the force between a pair of particles, the y component, and the position vector between two parts. That's this potential contribution that it exists. Every one of you has seen, if you were not aware, you have seen this experiment where you have steel balls hanging on a pendulum and one hitting the other. And if you look at this process, you see that there's practically instantaneous a transport of momentum over the distance corresponding to the diameter of a sphere. If these are hard spheres, this is referred to as collisional transfer. If you have continuous interaction potential, there's still a contribution which gives momentum transport expressed by the force, and that's exactly this quantity here. If it would be the trace of the pressure tensor, then it's the contribution of the pressure which is referred to as virial expression. So there are, in essence, two contributions which can be computed since we know the positions and velocities of these particles and have to be averaged. Typically, in these non-equilibrium computer simulations, one needs 10 to 100 times longer averages to get good signals compared with equilibrium. There are situations when it's also, So we know how to compute these quantities, and now if we compute, say, for a Lennard-Jones system at a density close to its triple point, that's a simulation which was done by Werner Luise about 15 years ago. If one plots this, the negative of this pressure tensor component, which is the stress tensor or the shear stress, as function of the shear rate, one sees here the potential and the kinetic contribution. The experimentalist only can measure the sum. In the simulation, we can extract them separately. And you see here, this is about 10 times larger. That's what happens in a dense fluid, as a density, triple point density system. In the gas, it would be the other way around. In the gas, this is present and this is very small. Now, if we divide this stress or pressure tensor component by the imposed shear rate, then we get the curve which I had shown you before. That's again the potential and the kinetic contribution to the viscosity. And there's a Newtonian behavior, and then this weak and strong shear thinning, and that's this behavior here. Same. Now, of course, well, this is still a very simple system. It's something which might mimic argon. This is the error bars, and this was run on a gray 15 years ago. Now you can easily do on a workstation with much better precision than. But it gives you an idea of how things behave and what you can observe.
So do we understand? Well, do we understand why these this potential contribution has the shape that it does? In other words,
what's going on? That's what I wanted to tell you now. It's good you are curious, because that's why the various colors I want to indicate that there are structural changes going on at these various color-coded regions. It's a Newtonian weak shear.
Can I just express a preference and ask you a question?
Yeah.
One is, fair enough, but an extreme preference for the upper of those two graphs rather than the lower. And the reason for that preference is that when you divide by the shear rate, of course, all the gradients change. A very significant feature of the upper graph is the maximum.
That's right.
Did the simulation, is that a real negative slope to the right of the maximum?
In this constrained system, in the real system, of course, you would have an instability, but this system is constrained. It was. Nowadays, we can do it with 100,000 particles, 50,000, 100,000 particles. This was run with 512 particles, a strongly constrained system. And if you relieve the constraint, then, of course, something like this.
Also, you must add both curves, right?
Right.
It's
but essentially, on the logarithmic scale, that's what's... If you work with a system large enough, then you will diameter of something.
Yeah, it's an order of magnitude bigger than that. So the maximum is real. The only point I want to make is when you make the plot of the so-called viscosity, you completely disguise the qualitative difference between gradients which are slightly larger.
If one is aware, then one knows if the slope approaches one, that something is happening here. If it's unstable, if it's one or even minus one or even smaller. Then
but you're saying the peak is a consequence of finite system size as opposed to...
The peak in a large system, but you would expect that something like this happens. Rather than...
And the peak still survives even for this size if you add both contributions.
Yeah, because this logarithmic, this is smaller than the size of the symbol.
So 10 is not enough.
Yeah, this is not enough. That's, I plotted it separately. Here you wouldn't see it, but it's a factor 10, about a bit bigger.
Does that mean you do have instability in your simulation?
Yes. We'll discuss what kind of, there are kind of a solution, yeah. Well, the question one can ask is what are the structural changes, and then some remarks on the structure of this simple system, the structure of fluids. The pair correlation function tells you something about the structure of fluids. What's the pair correlation function? You sit on a particle, look in the surroundings, and count how many particles you find in a certain distance. This gives you, if you average over all directions, the radial distribution function. Of course, as a reference particle, then you take the various particles. In a non-equilibrium situation, or if you would have some constraints, this function depends on the directions. It will have a directional dependence. So this g of r, the pair correlation function, is a function of the distance and the direction. And if you don't know anything, what this function will look like, you still can make an expansion with respect to spherical harmonics, like you do with a, learn to do with a wave function. And it contains a spherical or scalar part, which only depends on this r, which is not bold phase, is the magnitude. And then it contains angle-dependent terms. And from symmetry, one knows that it can only begin with a y2 term symmetry. There's no y1 because in the pair of particles, it doesn't matter whether you turn it by 180 degrees. And for the Couette flow, there are only particle symmetry. From symmetry, there are only three of the five terms possible. The one has the same symmetry as the xy. The same angle dependence, and then x squared minus y squared and z squared minus y squared. Here you see these are real and imaginary parts of the y22, and this is the y0, the angle dependence. And these quantities in front, then you have functions which depend only on the magnitude and the distance. And in the early days, we extracted these functions, putting in this information on the angle dependence and extracted these functions. And if you do this, one can reconstruct or analyze what the pair correlation function is doing. Incidentally, every one of you, I assume, has seen a pair correlation function in equilibrium. The first coordination and the second coordination. This is a similar, somewhat more dense system. Now, if one does this analysis with a pair correlation function and puts then the pair correlation function analyzed in this way together to get an image, one produces something which we had published in Reed. This was Howard Henley and Dennis Evans in 84. So you see, I'm telling you old stories. This was in Physics Today and about shear, and this gives an idea of what's happening there. This is an equilibrium, the reference particle that's just an artifact. And that's the first coordination shell. It's relatively thin, and that's the second coordination shell. If the system is sheared, then on average, there's a distortion of the first and second coordination shell. And this distortion, here the flow is in this direction, that direction, this distortion is actually of the kind which Poisson and Stokes and Maxwell knew over 100 years ago. The idea they expressed was you have a change in the structure of a liquid under shear, which you can think of, you freeze instantaneously, you freeze that liquid, make a shear deformation. If it was solid, you would know what the would be solid, you would know what the deformation is. Now, instead of the shear you would apply use in a solid, use in the fluid shear rate times the relaxation time, the Maxwell relaxation time. So it looks as if on an average, so this is a long time average, it looks as if the first and second coordination gel are deformed, and the deformation is given by deformation rate times relaxation time. And the relaxation time is that time, which structural relaxation time, which it takes. Say, if you turn off the shear, then you go back to this situation, this kind of relaxation time. And that's the basic idea which explains more or less what's going on in the region where the viscosity, well, I don't know, yeah, where one has the Newtonian viscosity in that regime. Now, if one the shear rate gets larger, what's happening, and this is not very well shown here, but I can try to explain it. This axis here is at small shear rates, this ellipsoidal axis, under 45 degrees. If you shear harder, then it's rotated away from the 45 degree direction. And the viscosity has to do with the XY, so say with the projection. And if you rotate it away, like you would orient a stick towards the flow direction, then the XY component gets smaller. That's why the viscosity gets somewhat smaller in this green regime.
Is there any scale of your shear rates?
Yeah.
Because what is the shear rate for the experiment?
Is it
very high compared to the
different? Yeah, level? I come. Yeah, thanks. I come to this point in it. It's a very important point for the because if you would like to do this with argon, you would need shear rates which are inaccessible, not at least in laboratory. Maybe in Livermore, when they make explosions, they might come close to it, but not in a laboratory. Well, this I will not go into the details. This behavior here, as I discussed it, can be quantized a little bit. We looked at what is referred to a generalized Maxwell model. I just want to give you an idea how one can calculate it. One starts out with an equation of change for the pair correlation function of the kind Kirkwood and Smilowski, Kirkwood had proposed, Kirkwood-Smilowski type. And this is the time change is given by a flow term, the flow term which is velocity times gradient, the velocity has a linear profile, then there's shear rate times the y component of the position vector, and you differentiate with respect to the x component in the pair. And then there is a damping term which guarantees that the system goes to equilibrium. The original Kirkwood expression is very complicated and it's an approximation and not good enough. If one really goes through a derivation, one notices there are a few more terms and fewer modifications which have to be added. It gets awfully complicated. That's why some time ago I said, well, let's replace this very complicated damping term by a relaxation time approximation. 1 over Maxwell relaxation time, g minus its equilibrium value. And if one plots this in, then one can solve this equation to all orders if one wants. And then one can compute these functions by basically the distortions of the pair correlation function in the stationary state are determined by derivatives of the equilibrium pair distribution function and multiplied by the shear rate. Here it's called gamma t. And this can be tested. That's what we did. Can be tested. One can compute these partial components in the pair correlation function, which look as functions like this g plus. That has to do with the xy. And the red curve is that thing which was directly computed in the simulation. And the green dashed curve is computed from the equilibrium pair correlation function by this Maxwell-Stokes assumption. And the height of this curve is adjusted such that, and this sets the relaxation time. So this peak, first peak here is adjusted, and then there's no further adjustable parameters, and then the other curves which give angular information are computed. You see, it's not perfect, but it gives the basic trend of the sun. So this gives some understanding. It's something like this in accord with that Maxwell model. Now, this was the story, as I told you. This explains what's going on here. the blue and green, but it does not explain things which happen here where one has a kind of instability. Now, this is something which came as a surprise in 84 in a hard sphere system. And I should probably talk a little bit about history. When molecular dynamics started and people looked at trajectories, you have seen, I was impressed long time ago by the pictures Alder had presented of particles moving, and I showed some of them. So simulators were looking at these trajectories, but eventually they got bored. And for at least 10 years, people who were in this business never looked at trajectories anymore because they had learned we don't see anything. And very few, I was relatively new into that field, so I did look. And there was also Erdenbeck who looked at spheres. And what was discovered is that at this, in the shear rate regions where some funny things are happening, the particles are really behaving in a strange way. And you can see a picture shown here. This was a simulation done by Werner Lose. It shows it's a Leonard Jones system. And this, the Leonard Jones particles are represented by circles here representing the Leonard Jones radius. And that's a few up or downstream. That's the y. The gradient is in this direction. You are looking, yeah, that's the velocity gradient sideways. You are looking up or downstream. And this here is the velocity profile. It's kinky because the velocity profile was analyzed. And that's the typical picture. And that's the kind of pictures people for 10 years didn't want to look at anymore. And what happens when the viscosity goes down is a kind of a partial positional ordering, which may look like this here. Particles have arranged, and they arrange such that they are flowing away from you, and they arrange in a certain manner, as you see if you wait at a, see people waiting at a street crossing, pedestrian crossing, at a right, at a red light. And they really wait, and there are enough of them, and then they start walking. You know that even in a dense system, they are walking through each other. But this is more effective, most effectively, if one is walking behind the other in a kind of tubes. And that's what the particles are doing here. They're also arranged in sheets. And what you see, there's also a plug-like flow. That's the velocity profile now. It's plug-like. There are layers which move together. And if one sees what happens here is a long-range ordered system. If one sees this, of course, one has to be worried with the periodic boundary conditions. Here, the periodic boundary conditions don't matter. That structure one observes here at a snapshot incident loop, that's averaged over long, many time steps. Such a snapshot has to be adjusted to the boundary layers. Now, there was a lot of controversy when this was observed. This was first reported in 84. That's another picture. Here you see tilted layers in the Leonard Jones system. This here shows the projections of the velocities. You see some of the particles are more or less frozen in these tubes. Some have large velocities because they have to transport momentum. Momentum transport is done by jump for the particles jumping from a fast to a slow and from a slow to a fast train, so to say. But they are not, they seem to be dense, but they are not dense. There's room for eight in this direction. And here, for instance, there's a tube where only two are. So it's easy for other particles to jump in. So as I said, when this came, one has to worry about boundary conditions. I show you a system where non-cubic boundary conditions were used. And they're seen from the side. One has different structures coexisting, and it's a velocity profile. So the actual picture one sees hinges on the periodic boundary conditions. What eventually we got convinced of is that the phenomenon is such that you can have a transition to a long-range positionally ordered system is genuine. The snapshot one sees not. And then, of course, now the question comes, is this real in the sense that you can observe it in real experiments? And that's now the question and concerning also the relaxation times. Because the relaxation time, you recall, the the effects one has, one notices in this model, the effects go with a dimensionless quantity. A dimensionless quantity is the shear rate times the relaxation time. To have observable effects of this kind, one needs this product, shear rate times relaxation time, to be of the order 10. Maybe 1/10 is sufficient, but it has to be of the order of 1. And if the relaxation time is 10 to the minus 12, as in liquid argon, you cannot realize shear rates 10 to the 12. However, I will show you there are substances where one can reach this regime. Now, if you want to see something like this in a real experiment, of course, you cannot trace particles, or it's difficult to trace particles. However, it is well known that the pair correlation function should also show these features, and the Fourier transform of the pair correlation function, which is the static structure factor here called Strukturfaktor, contains this similar information. And this, rather than taking the Fourier transform of the pair correlation function, it's much better to extract the S of K, the structure factor, directly from the simulation. And that this can be done is shown here. There are you can think in terms of an experiment which is done with a small angle neutron scattering. Then you fix a certain plane where you have your wave vector in, and this plane can be oriented differently with respect to the flow velocity, and there are three orientations. This is in a stage where one has not, a typical liquid stage, where one has not yet this long-range positional ordering. And this here is above. So in this case, shear rate dimensionless 1.3, 1.5. This is the plane in the where the flow goes on. Here one sees elliptically distorted pair correlation function, just like an elliptically distorted static structure factor, just like one knows has an elliptically distorted pair correlation function. Now, of course, this is still computer simulation. Now, how will we go to real life? I will be brief on that. So far, I told you the simulations were invented to treat something like an atomic fluid. Think in terms of argon, where you have, you know, nanometer scale, figure these particles. I mentioned colloidal dispersions. Colloidal dispersions where you have here on the 1,000 nanometer, few hundred nanometer scale particles. And the idea is if I have a dense colloidal dispersions with forces dominating the interaction between those, the structure at least, the structural properties should be different. There is the solution in between. Of course, in here, there's no solution. However, we have a homogeneous thermostat, which is nicely provided by such a solution that we take the heat out locally everywhere, so to say. However, in the first go, we do not take into account any additional friction, Brownian forces, and things like this. However, in these colloidal dispersions, there are experiments. And about 10 years ago, we had an article published, and I like to show this article. This shows rheological and small angle neutron studies and computer simulations. And as I mentioned, I'm quite proud of this publication, because the number of authors is only one order of magnitude away from what you have in elementary particle physics. And it shows people who made the substances and some theoreticians who also helped in the measurements. And very important, the experiment was done at the Institut Laue Langevin in Grenoble. Peter Lindner was providing the local support. And what was done there is, well, one looked at a substance, one of these substances with a flow curve, viscosity with a shear rate. And I show you data, now measurements taken from these points here on the flow curves. And first, the setup, to give you some feeling. Small angle neutron scattering measurements. There's the neutrons coming from the reactor. Here's the flow cell. Could be a Poiseuille or a Couette flow. Both were used. And 20 meters away, there's a detector, 64 by 64 by 64 centimeters. So this 20 meters gives you a feeling what a small angle means. And there one can see an equilibrium, something like the Bischerer rings. And I will show you the equilibrium picture. This is the scattering scene there. I hope it's the right one here. This wasn't in Ruhe, somewhere it says here. This is the first debaching, first peak in the steric structure factor, not entirely isotropic, but rather isotropic. And that's a picture which could be taken off the screen after 10 minutes. So the substance is scattering very well. We had 2 days of beam time and could do a lot of measurements. Now, if the shear is put on, and we saw it for the first time, it was really dramatic. Sheared the system, let it flow, it was a small shear. And that picture I had shown you changes the disk. This is probably taking integration time, maybe 20 minutes, I'd say. And then it has totally changed, and with this, even qualitatively, you see dramatic things have happened. However, it looks like Bragg peaks. Bragg peaks would mean they are very, very high. These are relatively still very wide peaks. So there's a preferential some ordering going on. This is the peak seen where it's flowing, where the viscosity curve goes down rather steeply. Yeah?
This sample is not ordered.
It's not ordered. That's at rest. At rest means at this was here at the 52% concentration, that the substance, it's very stiff, that substance. So it was sitting 6 hours before them. Six hours still before this measurement was taken. That's the picture at rest, and then you turn it on, and then shear, and then after.
If you would take something which is already ordered, like a cubic phase, you would get more or less the same thing.
Yes. Similar, very similar.
Just with the peak.
Very similar. It gets something very similar. So, and if one now goes to the region where the viscosity goes up, again there's a change, and it looks different qualitatively. It looks like this. Those well-ordered peaks have gone. If you have a close look, then you have higher intensity here. It's a more and lower there. It's more stronger elliptically. And I should say here what the geometry is. You are looking at the beam is going along the gradient direction. It was actually, these measurements were done in a Poisson flow. So it's flowing like this, and the beam is going through like that. And where there is the detector. There was also tilted, and a lot of information. Now there was Peter Lindner had also a Couet apparatus, which is closer to the simulation, and which could be used at the smaller volume fraction, 40, 42 or so, that the peaks are even much nicer in the Couet flow because the velocity profile is better defined. Now we looked again to our computer simulation pictures, and now these are those from the Couet apparatus. That's this picture from the suns, and these are the contour lines from the suns, the equivalent information. Well, there is some choice you can make which lines you draw, which equi-height lines. And that's the corresponding picture from our non-equilibrium molecular dynamics simulation. However, here we have inserted a form factor. We computed a pair structure factor, we have inserted a form factor. A form factor for a spherical particle whose radius is known, because these particles were seen under the electron microscope, and they are very monodispersed. That's the whole trick. They have to be very monodispersed to have this increasing shear rate. So we know it. That's a, so it's computer simulation plus this form factor. What the form factor does is it suppresses the intensities of those peaks which are further out. You see it at glance, there's very strong correspondence. So what we know is now that the structure we observe in the computer simulation under conditions which are similar to the flow field, where we have a strong decrease of the viscosity in the real substance, where we have a strong decrease of the viscosity in the computer, there we see the structures which are very similar. Of course, if we want to now to compare the dynamics, we have quantitatively, we have to do much more. We would have to insert the friction of the background fluid, and that's a longer story. I don't want to go into this story now. In the what we had aimed at to look at in the computer simulation at the increase of the viscosity, we have seen it, but there were so many weird things going on, and it was so expensive to run the simulations at this high shear rates, because one has to go to very small and small time steps, and the system was behaving in non-ergodic way. So in those days, which are over 10 years ago, we gave up studying these substances. We rather focused on studying other complex fluids, where you can observe many interesting phenomena, and like liquid crystals, ferrofluids, magnetorheological fluids, polymers. And I have, I'm just looking around. I don't know how things usually run. After 50 or 60 minutes, I might show you 5, 6, 7 transparencies just to get you interested in, without having the chance to explain what's done, such that questions for future things can be asked.
To your question is that there isn't very much a usual, but no one should expect to get out of here within an hour. not these meetings, but everyone should certainly have the expectation to be
within
an hour and a half. So,
the
magic
number is noon, in other words.
No, I don't realize.
But the last quarter of an hour should be discussion.
Okay. So I just show you a few transparencies, however, without being able to explain things, just to make you curious, and then you can ask questions to Martin Krueger and me. One item I mentioned are liquid crystals. Here you see a nice picture made by Thomas Kuhn of liquid crystals in contact with wall arranging. We have also sheared systems of that kind. And what's of interest in these systems and the liquid crystals is that instead of one viscosity, now you can think of you have more viscosities, like a Miesewitch viscosity. You can have an external field applied or some other means to orient particles in this direction or that direction or that direction or that. Then you see they will have different viscosities. This Erikson-Leslie viscosities, or you also have flow alignment, which there are substances where you have a stable orientation of the director, not of the single molecules, only of the director field or maybe dumpling. And this now it's not only one viscosity, it's a whole set of viscosity coefficients which one can analyze. That the emphasis is not on the high shear rate, but rather small shear rates and the anisotropy of the viscosity. We have analyzed this for various systems, ellipsoids and Gay-Byrne particles, and that's, for instance, a simulation where done by Loris Bennett in Berlin, where this the viscosities, that's the viscosity for this orientation, that's the highest one. This is the viscosity where the particles are oriented that way, and that's the intermediate viscosity as function of the density. And in this, the density have somewhat strange values for this Gay-Byrne systems. Anyway, one knows this is nemetic, and there is a transition to the smectic. And there is an approach. The smallest viscosity is approaching the average one. One observes, expects there will be even a diverging when the nemetic system goes over to a smectic. That's the kind of phenomenon one can study, also the structural rearrangements. Other systems we looked at, and this was a simulation done with Martin Krueger and Afuar, is to look at model particles which are partially stiff and partially flexible. So you have particles in a bead, and the ends are flexible. And that's how they look like in a solid phase. If you go to a smacking phase, that's if you take a snapshot of these particles, then they have stiff parts still arranged, and then the ends are wiggling around, and these wiggling particles can still be heated up when they go to they hardly have any nematic phase, and for this modeling go to the isotropic phase, and this can be sheared and studied. That's the kind of games one can play instead of worrying about what's happening at extreme deviations from equilibrium, to stay close to equilibrium, but we have more complicated molecules and more complicated interactions. A different type of anisotropic systems we looked into were colloidal particles which have a magnetic moment and which are oriented, all ferrofluids or magnetorheological fluids. And then one has the magnetic, if the orientation is fixed, one has interaction which is attractive for this situation and repulsive for that situation. These particles also form more can form at higher densities more complicated structures, strings and planes, and those can be sheared. And just to give you an idea what has been done and can be done is, for instance, to look at a substance where one has a relatively high concentration. This corresponded to a substance where one has had almost 40% volume occupied by these colloidal particles, and a few of these strings, they form strings, are sheared, and then one follows this under shear. Of course, these are strings which are breaking and reforming, and we analyze the viscous properties and the structural changes. All these things can be done with the similar techniques. That's ferrofluid, and now I promised polymers, and this is just, again, to indicate what can be done and has been done, and you can inquire about what has been done. That's a near picture produced by Martin Kröger. You can model a polymeric chain if you start, so to say, with atoms and give some of the atoms an extra binding force. What was used here is that all particles were purely repulsive interaction. The WCA, Leonard Jones cutoff in its minimum, plus affine potential attraction. We used the same potential as Kramer and Crest used, because they had done a lot of equilibrium studies on substances of this kind. And the same interaction potential was used, same density, temperature, and then this system put under shear. This is a relatively short chain. These were just 30 peats. This was close to equilibrium. Then an intermediate shear rate, large shear rates, you can stretch this. And that's one chain out of a melt. We also looked at chains in solutions, but that's one chain out of the melt. And I can make some, the way it was modeled is depicted here again. That's this fine potential. It has a finite range. It takes into account that these bonds can only be extracted to a finite distance. If you allow breaking, and that's what Martin Kröger has done, if you allow breaking, then you can simulate living polymers, micellar systems, which are called, which are not polymers, but called living polymers, breaking and reforming, incidentally. And that's the kind of modeling done. And here I should make some propaganda for something Martin has done some time ago. And there was a FISREF letter almost 2 years ago by now. That's the viscosity shown as function of the shear rate. That's an older picture in this FISREF letter. There are newer data. And viscosity as function of shear rate for various chain lengths. And you see that it's a logarithmic. If the chains get longer and longer and the polymeric melt, then the viscosity gets higher. It was a tremendous task to determine here the low shear rate limit. It's much easier to get data up here rather than small, really small, small. And in here, it even goes down to smaller. And it needs long, long ride of time. And he was using parallel machine alone in Berlin to collect the data, which make the difference between this figure and the figures shown there. But the essential method, these are world records in various respects. But the essential message is, if you analyze this viscosity for small shear rates as function of the chain length, then there is a changeover. It's at small chain lengths, it's increasing linearly, and then there's a stronger increase. Linear, that's referred to as Raus. And then the power 3 point something, it's around 3.4 or 3.5. This is associated with reptation. So this, I must say, this turnover, this kink, was seen 5 years earlier, but there were data collected in the meantime really to quantify this, or to make the error bar smaller and to be sure. Now, that's, I think, quite an achievement, because I don't know who of you has seen pictures like this. That's a page from from that source, but I copied it from the book of Hirschfelder, of Bird and Armstrong. So anyway, what it shows, these are experiments where you show this kink, the change in the slope as function of the molecular weight and in the viscosity. So this kink, which one has here, also allows, so let's say, a scaling to find out the model we used was a Kuhn type model, not a microscopic modeling of CH2 groups, for instance, but a Kuhn group. This allows to coordinate it or associate it with the molecular weight here at this point to know how many monomers really correspond to one of our beads we have in the simulation. And typically there are 3 to 10 in the typical numbers, probably 6 or 7 in this. Of course, one can also look at structural properties. That's what was done by Martin early days again. Look at the static structure factor from, well, single chains, which should say analogous to a two-rate system, or from the whole system. Anyway, one can produce nice pictures, see the structural changes. And since there are a few people from Strasbourg here, a few years ago there was René Müller visiting in Berlin, and also we had some contact with Pico. And they had noticed for the small k vector, there is an elliptical distortion in the static structure factor. And they noticed that for the various k's, the axis is not pointing in the same direction. And from these pictures, I must confess, from these pictures, I would have overlooked that feature. But since they told us, they have seen it in an experiment, and we looked at our computer simulation data, and lo and behold, the same feature was seen. And this was a comparison made now with the experiments, suns, neutron scattering done on the polymers by Müller and co-workers. That's that angle here as function of the wave vector. And the circles are the computer simulation data, and that is the experimental data taken for a system where one is sitting on the same region in the flow curve, so to say. One looks, how does the viscosity as function of the shear rate look like qualitatively, not quantitatively? We do not have a quantitative comparison for the viscosity. How does it look qualitatively where these certain structural features appear? And now we see it here in the computer simulation again. This was a relatively already seen in the...
Because those data were not taken under conditions of steady shear. They just had their sliding plates. They were all finite strains. But your calculations also on the finite strains.
Steady. Well, it's even funnier here, the steady. It was believed to be a steady state measurement, but they quenched their samples, froze them, and then had the solid samples put into the beam scattering it.
But they weren't, well, you know.
Okay, they are similar situations there. Yeah. Well, of course, you can go to the polymers and can do extensional flow. That's what Harald Vogt also did, and that's a picture from Harald Vogt. And I should tell Martin Kruger had invented a method to detect entanglements. You ask him and let him explain how it's done. With this method, you can pick out chains from a melt. It's filled. The whole picture, in principle, is filled. But there are interesting ones filled. And you see the chain lengths 480. They are pulled in an extensional flow. And there are a kind of entanglement and kinks formed. And this can be analyzed and studied by looking at them, counting them. That's another thing which was done. And since there's an entanglement at the end, I will surely come to an end. I mentioned you should ask Martin how this really can be done. But I want to point out that in Berlin, where we are qualified to look at entanglements, more qualified than probably anywhere else, because we already have a monument for an entanglement. So we know what an entanglement is. Well, and at this point, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
ask you a question about this culture?
Yeah.
I mean, I know this culture, and I noticed that it looks like my cells making some breaking. Do you think the author of this culture was thinking about that?
I'm not aware, but I take this as a research project and I return to Berlin.
In the cases of going back a little ways where you were doing colloidal systems and so forth, it wasn't obvious, clear to me from what you said what you do about the intervening fluid. Do the particles interact with each other hydrodynamically or just via interaction potentials or?
The data I showed you were just interaction plus thermostat in the background. But we have also done simulations of a kind of a Brownian dynamics where we have a friction acting on the particle and a plus a fluctuating force. And we tuned that friction and fluctuating force to go from a molecular dynamics over to a Brownian dynamics. And looked at scale. We felt we probably don't insert any hydrodynamic interaction, but see what's happening there. And actually, I do have curves and graphs somewhere here. Maybe we discuss in private. So we looked at this point. If one really wants to make the contact with the experiments, one has to go through the Brownian dynamics situation. Or close to Brownian dynamics, really, to correlate in the real experiment, they know what the viscosity of the background fluid, what the dense fluid is, and this correlates more nicely. And the viscosity, of course, changes by many orders of magnitudes, if I recall correctly, 3 or 4 orders of magnitude on this scale can be achieved by change. We also have seen it in the polymeric system, there are tremendous changes. And this should be done. But we did not look at, in this simulation, a true hydrodynamic induction.
I wanted to ask one other question, that is to the liquid crystal ones you do. In what way do you, what's the nature of the ellipsoid interactions or something that you put into this to make it?
The first studies on liquid crystals we did was using an affine transformation model. So the very first idea was to look for the anisotropy, start with perfectly and oriented molecules, which emerge from which you can produce, say, from a Leonard Jones by making an affine transformation and keeping the volume constant. Then this has some advantages because one knows theoretical expressions. That's what we did in simulations. Confirmed some theoretical models, which actually, in one way, goes back to Helfrich a long time ago. And then, of course, one wants to go to the next step where one has particles which can turn around. There are the Gay-Byrne potentials on the market, which in essence is a Leonard Jones, but with a directional, well, it depends on the orientation of one, well, the other, and the vector in between. And what you make depend on these angles, is the effective size, which goes in, the length, and the prefactor, the energy in front. And there are 2 additional parameters in this Gay-Byrne model, so then can play around. And there are various values of these parameters where phase diagrams are chosen. That's on the market, what one can do. Recently, we looked at a simpler modulation where we have basically play only with the energetic degree of freedom, which is a model which is easier to handle than the Gay-Byrne. Then there are others who have really looked at spherocylinders for equilibrium studies. Dan Frankel, for instance, has done a lot of work, and Mike Allen on the equilibrium properties of cylindrically hard objects. All these have been. So, and you can study then in equilibrium, non-equilibrium. We also looked at the phenomena around nematic-smectic transitions. That was what kind of phenomenon. But it's a hard job in the simulation also.
See, can I just come back to the colloids and the shearing planes again? Because mm-hmm. I still haven't
extracted a clear picture of where we are now in this problem. I remember also in the 80s, you had David Hayes in the UK banging on and on about the hard sphere simulations, which always seem to show this planar ordering. But I always worried about those, and I've heard other people say that that's, you know, essentially an artifact. It's always an artifact of how you do your simulation. It's not my area, but I'd like someone to tell me whether this effect is, well, you said it's experimentally real, but to what extent is it sensitive to the potentials, the interactions, whether it exists for the hard sphere theory, or whether the hard sphere theory is a pathological object?
No, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't say the hard sphere is pathological. You need a repulsion which is, I think, you need a repulsion which is strong enough, and that something is happening there. That's one of these curves. That a transition, something is happening there, can also be guessed if one looks at the flow behavior. That's what we did some time ago. Look at the behavior of a fluid here, which is has nonlinear viscous properties, where one knows not only the viscosity but the normal stress differences, which we also measured. I didn't mention it here. And then one can conclude by looking at hydrodynamics and putting in the knowledge of the viscous properties, including the normal stress differences. From this behavior here, one can make a stability analysis. We concluded that something must happen because this branch here is getting unstable. Where it will go to, what kind of structure it forms, cannot be told. So in this respect, I believe that this is genuine. The pictures we show, that depends on the boundary conditions shown and things. But I think it's a genuine phenomenon that you can push, can drive a system into a partially positional ordered state. It can be layer, tilted layer, strings flowing in that direction. There were, Dennis Evans in these years had produced pictures of strings in the gradient direction. These are artifacts. You look at them, they are certainly unstable. But strings in moving in the flow direction, I believe they're really existing. And that's the kind of structure we saw in this colloidal dispersion. Of course, in the colloidal dispersion, you might think that it's polycrystalline and it's oriented.
And what the strain hardening regime which succeeds the rapidly thinning regime, can you probe the simulations to extract the breakup of the strings or how?
The picture I have about this increase is that you have somehow layers formed where the viscosity is low, and then since those layers get unstable, you have this twirling around. It's not turbulence, but it's something like that instability, which makes it the viscosity go up again.
Is there a critical wave then for that instability? Do you want that to
be? There have suggestions been made. But, in the simulations, it's just the molecular layer, not a hydrodynamic length. But in the real system, I expect that it's a couple of layers.
An idea like the one you expressed seems to suggest that you would not run into this if the concentration was pushed higher and higher. In other words, eventually, this system is not close packed exactly, but getting extremely concentrated. You wouldn't think that these kind of large scale overturning sort of
During the last years, we got interested in solid friction under extreme conditions. So we are studying plastic flow of metal-like systems. So we start out with ideal crystals and subject them to shear to see plastic flow. And there's also some similar phenomena occurring. That system, even when the metal can readjust, form a new structure, but then it's more or less a crystal-like structure where you have layers flowing. The system finds the optimal layers where it can flow in the optimal way if you force it to undergo plastic flow. Even there, even in the very dense system, if you start with the wrong orientation, then you locally reorient the sample.
What kind of volume fractions are we talking about?
This here around 40 to 50%, around 50% here. And this was done at triple point, Leonard Jones triple point density, which is, well, maybe if you think in terms of volume fractions, a little bit less than one half. It's about 0.45 or something.
So I imagine the onset of all of these transitions or changes in the structure depend on the concentration, right?
Yeah, very much so. And if the concentration is too low, then you won't see it. And it also depends, in the real system, it also depends very critically on the monodispersity. If you have a polydispersed system, it gets more or less washed out.
Is there a general curve for the set, or the onset of this thing?
Not that I know of. Right. Maybe.
The time by which you make the shear rate dimensions of these colloidal simulations, what is that? Is that the decay, the correlation time of S, Q, and T at the first people?
The time you can, good time scale you can use is the time it takes a particle to diffuse of a half its diameter due to the viscosity of the background fluid. That's a good chance. And this also has a name. I don't know whether. Forgot that there are De Bora and Weissenberg. And
the question about hard sphere fluid in the back of my mind was puzzled. Maybe some Gary can help me with that. Is that when you turn Brownian motion off, you can do simulations on hard spheres with no Brownian motion. And under those conditions, there is no internal time scale at all. It's not one that I can see. And yet people publish happy flow curves with structure data.
But a hard sphere fluid does have a viscosity.
I'm talking about this very strange system where you just turn Brownian motion off.
Even a genuine hard sphere fluid does have a viscosity. It has a viscosity in the gas. And why shouldn't it have a well-defined viscosity in its liquid state? It's not fluid state when you compress it. And the time scale, if you want to associate with structural relaxation time would be a time.
There isn't one. If you have no, I know this is very artificial. If you have no Brownian motion, there is no structural relaxation time at all. The only time scale is that set by the flow. So you shouldn't really be able to change your Weissenberg number at all. There's only one Weissenberg number allowed. So you see, but for that scaling analysis, you would expect any shear flow of a non-Brownian hard sphere to have no structure in it whatsoever. Suppose one tries to strengthen that into a proof of machine learning structure. Yes, therefore, if you see structure, there must be some artifact of your simulation which is creating a time scale where it didn't ought to have one.
I wouldn't call it an artifact. I can offer you one excuse, so to say. That's the thermostat. Of course, it's a thermostatic system. It's not a pure, which is a global coupling between all particles in a certain sense. It's a thermostat.
How do you define the viscosity of this frame?
Of course, you can only define the viscosity once you start shearing.
What you're describing is a gas.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Even the ideal gas, Boltzmann gas, does have a viscosity. It has the ideal state law, but still has collisions to make the viscosity non-zero.
I guess what's happening is that
But you are to come back to that relaxation time. One means to define a relaxation time was, of course, as Maxwell did it, divide the viscosity by the shear modulus, high frequency shear modulus in the case of a liquid. However, I do not know how to compute the high frequency shear modulus for a hard sphere system. I don't know how to compute it for any smooth potential. The low frequency shear modulus can be computed for the hard spheres, but not the.
Exactly. Okay. But my concern is that's rather uncontrolled.
Yeah.
And you don't really quite know what's going on in these pure hard sphere.
Right.
Okay.
Saxe-Gedenk, or raw brush.
I think we'll be,